Hey, strangers, before we jump into today's episode, just a note to let you know that my new contract with my ad seller requires 4 ad breaks per episode now. I am doing my best to make the episodes longer to accommodate. I know no one loves ads, but them's the breaks in capitalism. Remember, there are a few options if you want to skip the ads. You can always do it manually, or you can now subscribe through Apple Podcasts and become a casual stranger where you'll get early and ad-free regular episodes, plus the new Strange News Weekly Addendum. Or you can sign up on Patreon at patreon.com/grabbadcollab, where for just $8 a month, you'll get early and ad-free Strange, plus all the other amazing content at GrabBag, all ad-free. We have 3 regular weekly shows and a whole handful of quarterly miniseries and bi-weekly shows, all for just $8 a month. See you there, and enjoy. What is identity? What makes us who we are? Is it the color of our skin? The people we come from? The people we love? What might drive a person to shed one identity for another? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I am what we like to call a mutt. Growing up, I thought I was Irish and Russian. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I realized that not only was that reductive, it was also just plain wrong. Despite Russia's best efforts, Ukraine is not indeed Russia. I am no more Russian than I am Canadian. But even these two nationalities ignore the veritable smorgasbord of other countries from which my ancestors migrated. To say that I am Ukrainian and Irish completely erases the matrilineal lines on both sides. I am, according to my DNA, 1% Sardinian, but I would never go around claiming to be Italian. Though frankly, most Sardinians wouldn't claim to be Italian either, but that's beside the point. The only time I claim my Italian heritage is when I put my fingers together and say something like, I make it a meatball. But, bad comedy aside, unless I have some claim to ancestral land there, I'm not gonna try to pretend I'm Italian. The one thing all my family branches have in common, like the spindly birch tree, is their whiteness. True, my Irish and Jewish ancestors who came here were considered less worthy of respect than the English ones, but in the made-up hierarchy of race, they were still given more respect and privilege than black folk. It would have been remarkable, to say the least, then, if one of those people had decided to adopt the identity of a black person. No one in my family did that, as far as I know, but some white people have, for one reason or another, assumed identities as black people. These days, one can only assume there is a fetishization of a culture other than one's own that drives such a choice. I'm looking at you, Rachel Dolezal. But for Clarence King, a white man living in America in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, where parts of the country operated under deeply racist Jim Crow laws, and the whole country was still deeply segregated, the reasons may have been a lot more complex. Love can make a man do interesting things. Clarence King was many things, but he was never ordinary. He fancied himself something of a rugged mountain man, but couldn't quite shake the edifices of his Tony Newport, Rhode Island upbringing. So while he was intrepid enough to traverse largely unexplored terrain for the purposes of topographical measuring, he brought along a valet who would dress him for dinners at the campfire. Born in 1842, he was of the generation of geologists and other natural scientists responsible for the mapping of the American West, helping to fan the flames of white expansion from the Midwest to the Pacific Ocean. He was curious about all things, both topographical and human. He loved the beauty of raw nature, the intricacies of learning, and the magnificence of a great Bordeaux. La-di-da. Or, as he is described by the Smithsonian on their National Portrait Gallery website, quote, King was a man of science who stepped easily into literature, end quote. When King died, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Henry Adams called him, quote, the best and brightest man of his generation, with talents immeasurably beyond any of his contemporaries, end quote. King could trace his ancestry back to Alfred the Great and 3 signers of the Magna Carta. His father died when he was very young, and his two younger sisters died before he was six. Rumors still persist that King's father, who perished while abroad, was involved in the Chinese opium trade, which is not important to our story, but I thought I'd throw it in. Raised by his mother Florence, he was also greatly influenced by her, his grandmother, Sophia Little, and the constancy of a domestic servant, a woman of color whose name, unfortunately, is lost to history, all of whom he held in high regard for the remainder of his life. According to his biographer, Martha Sandwise, King's ardent disdain for slavery was sown early on by his grandmother. Sandwise found this passage that Clarence wrote to a friend about his grandmother's ardency. Quote, during the 1850s, she ate no sugar but free soil maple and refused southern oranges as they were, to her mind, full of the blood of slaves, end quote. In fact, Sophia Little was known to the great abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass. She witnessed a mob drag abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison away with a rope tied around his neck, and likely as a result of this, she was not just one who talked the talk. She regularly contributed to the abolitionist weekly, The Liberator. Sandwise notes that Sophia Little wrote an anti-slavery novel called Thrice Through the Furnace, which, though written just before Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, it was published after that 1852 history-altering work due to publishing delays. Douglass's Rochester newspaper gave Little's book a great review when it came out, writing that it was a powerful attack on the Fugitive Slave Act. By 1856, the family had fallen on some trying financial times with the total failure of his late father's Chinese business investments. King turned 18 in 1860, a year in which it was impossible to be uninterested in politics. The country was on the threshold of a civil war, with the North and South bitterly divided over the future of the Union. This, coupled with King's uncertainty about his own personal future, threw him into a depression that would dog him for the rest of his life. But he had friends who bolstered him. Two of his dearest friends were, in fact, well connected to the political elite of this country. Henry Adams was the grandson of one American president and the great-grandson of another. John Hay would go on to be Abraham Lincoln's private secretary and later Secretary of State. And even with the specter of depression always lurking, King went on to become an explorer and a mountaineer, a volcanologist, which is not, as it might sound, one who studies Mr. Spock, but one who studies volcanoes, and a surveyor and the first director of the U.S. Geological Survey. And here I can barely bring myself to shower on a daily basis. But all these accomplishments and attributes, while laudatory and vast, are not the most interesting thing about Clarence King. They don't even come close. Ada Copeland was born in a small town in rural Georgia, most likely in 1860. It's likely she was born into slavery on a cotton plantation, though not much is known about her early life except that it began just as the Civil War did. Because Ada was born in the days just before Georgia seceded from the Union, it's fair to say her childhood was almost certainly one of poverty and war. No one really knows where she acquired the last name of Copeland, because as such, she does not appear in any census records until much later. It may have been the last name of the slavers under whom she was born. But she was still quite young when slavery was abolished. According to the Department of Commerce, even in 1890, almost 70% of all black citizens in Georgia were unable to read or write. The older you were, the less likely those chances were. But Ada was young and likely became literate enough to get by. She was clearly smart enough and ambitious enough to get out of Georgia and move to New York City as a young adult, landing maybe at a relative's Greenwich Village home sometime in the mid-1880s. Ada found work as a nursemaid in a household in Lower Manhattan, which likely meant she was a live-in nanny who worked long hours. In late 1887, Ada happened to meet a man 20 years her senior, and they began to, as they said in those days, court. He told her he had a good job. He was a Pullman porter, He was handsome and kind. His name, he told her, was James Todd. Ada knew that porters on the Pullman Company line were clean-cut and highly disciplined. They were the men who attended to the needs of wealthy white folk as they traveled in luxurious high-end sleeping cars, now carrying them across the length and breadth of this country. The porters were responsible for the care of their passengers, everything from carrying luggage to maintaining berths, to serving meals and providing entertainment for the long trips between urban centers. In time, historians would credit Pullman porters with helping to create the black middle class in America. As they were professional men in professional settings who were paid relatively well and thus could afford college for their children. LOL. Imagine being able to afford college. Not only that, but by forming the first African-American labor union under the umbrella of the American Federation of Labor, the Pullman porters laid the groundwork for the important civil rights work yet to come. Ada had found a treasure. Sure, he was older, and yes, he'd be gone a lot while working, but he'd provide a good home for her and for any children they might have. He also clearly loved her very much. Her life was about to get better. Meanwhile, Clarence King had not been idle during his post-college years. He graduated from Yale with a degree in chemistry in 1862, and despite his feelings about abolishing slavery, he did not serve in the Union Army. Instead, he went west. According to an essay written for the Boone and Crockett Club, an elite conservation and wildlife management group, the young Yale grad first traveled with some friends to St. Louis, where a family invited them to join their wagon train. The young men agreed and were given the task of taking care of the family's animals. According to essayist P.J. Delhomme, once the family made it to the Pacific coast, King took a steamship to San Francisco, where, while on board, he met William Henry Brewer of the California Geologic Survey. King, being a good kid with a curious mind, volunteered to help Brewer with his work. Brewer was only too delighted to let him. As part of the survey, King's team explored, mapping as they went, the northern reaches of the Sierra Nevada Mountains and the California Gold Country. Delhomme wrote that it was here that Clarence, quote, eventually identified an age of gold-bearing rocks by linking those rocks with fossils, end quote. Around this time, Clarence and James Gardner, one of his closest buddies from high school, hooked up and decided they'd like to survey the Great Basin. The Great Basin, by the by, is a large area in the western U.S. that is composed of seasonal lakes and swamps that have no outlet to any sea. The water in those basins also tends to evaporate seasonally. Think of the barren but beautiful vastness of Nevada and western Utah, where glaciers carved the landscape and some of the oldest trees on Earth still live. The previously unmapped region deeply intrigued King and Gardner. But first, they'd need cash to mount the expedition. So, Clarence went to Washington, D.C. to extol the virtues of their idea. Hard to say if it was the idea or his connections, but King and Gardner got 5 years' worth of financial backing to take on the mapping along the 40th parallel north from northeastern California through Nevada and into eastern Wyoming. As a result, in 1872, King published, quote, Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada, and, as a sideline, debunked a widely held claim that Arizona was the home of a vast diamond field. That story goes that before they became successful in their respective fields of banking and jewelry, Baron von Rothschild and Charles Tiffany walked into a California bank with a handful of diamonds and casually told anyone who would listen that a particular part of Arizona was covered with them. I don't know why they did this or what their aim was, but while most were thrilled at the idea that Arizona was littered with diamonds, free for the taking, Clarence King was like, I don't think so, and went there, ultimately proving that the diamonds had been planted there, and more specifically, they had originated in South Africa. When King returned to New York in late 1873, he was famous, I guess, for mapping and myth-busting, and soon enough, he was the recipient of various scientific honors and the topic of a lot of discussion. He was charming, colorful, and a great conversationalist. Biographer Thurman Wilkins noted that one of his friends once said, quote, "The trouble with King is that his description of a sunset spoils the original," end quote. He was very deep in writing about his Western work during the day, then dining among the well-heeled and powerful East Coast elite during the early evening. At night, though, only one or two of his friends knew that he enjoyed walking the streets of New York's other neighborhoods where other kinds of people lived and played. King's secretary, Edgar Beecher Bronson, later went on to write a memoir, Reminiscences of a Ranchman, in which he detailed his apprenticeship with King. Quote, "With a learning so comprehensive and profound as to have maintained him among the foremost savants of his generation, the hours dearest to him were spent in absolute or semi-savagery," end quote. Savagery, meaning not wealthy wasps. Yikes. King walked the streets of unfamiliar neighborhoods purely out of curiosity and interest. He was very interested in how other people lived. While on the open range, Bronson wrote, King chose to sit and observe what he didn't understand or know. Among the local indigenous folk, he eyed them closely as they played games. He'd sit by a fireside during their rituals or sit, quote, "silent in a Negro cabin, listening to the croonings of a turbaned black grandmother, hungry for some sort of voodoo mysteries. Such were the hours he loved best," end quote. Okay, listen, this was a different time. I'm going to assume he meant that King was hungry for voodoo mysteries, not the grandmother. Honestly, she was probably just putting her grandkids to bed, and he was sitting there thinking, ooh, this is probably some ancient voodoo ritual. Like that recent video of the tourists sitting in a woman's home while she pounds coffee by hand, and they all think she's just sitting there making music for them, so they start clapping along. Anyway. King spent some of the 1870s abroad, and after spending 2 years in Europe, friends noted that when he left, the barmaids of London would miss him. Good for him. King's professional reputation grew such that when, in 1879, the various surveys of American territory needed to be consolidated, President Rutherford B. Hayes nominated King to lead the newly formed U.S. Geological Survey. King obliged. He set the whole service up, organized the chaos, and 2 years later passed it on to John Wesley Powell. Powell was famously the first white man to ever ride and record the length of the Colorado River through the treacherous Grand Canyon. Awaiting his next big adventure, King could always be counted on to be the eligible bachelor, the plus one, if you will, at dinners and parties, the blind date the friend offered up to escort some young, lovely woman around town. But his friends had almost given up on getting him attached, though they all acknowledged that he was hip deep in trying to take care of his grandmother as well as his beloved mother, who was said to be going downhill, both physically and mentally. She had remarried in 1860, inherited a stepson with severe disabilities, and had two more small children with her new husband, who died just 6 years into the marriage. King was left to be the sole provider for her, his grandmother, and his step-siblings. He was quite selfless, but that didn't mean he didn't want his own life. Sometime in 1879, King wrote to his friend John Hay about his own desire to find a life companion. Sandwise, in Passing Strange, quotes from it, quote, "The New York woman," he wrote, "seemed to have a mind that was a mere crazy quilt of bright odds and ends, snips of polite error patched in with remnants of truth which don't show the whole pattern, little rags of scandal all deftly sewn together in a pretty chromatic chaos well calculated to please a congenital dude, but fatiguing to a lover of natural women, such as I am," end quote. And this is how I learned that dudes in the 1800s used the word dude.
Oh, he lives, hey, dude!
Sandwise finds this dichotomy to be perhaps the only telling clue to what was about to happen. She writes, quote, "At some point, he began to imagine that he could slip the bounds of upper crust respectability to live as someone else, not just on his nighttime rambles, but in a deeper, more sustained way," end quote. There is no diary or letter to help us out on how Clarence King met Ada Copeland, nor is there any way to know why he decided to not introduce himself to her as a man of adventure and acclaim. Instead, he told her his name was James Todd. Blonde and blue-eyed, King stuck to his story that he too was of African descent by way of the West Indies, where he'd been born and raised by West Indian parents. He said he worked a rather prescribed life, serving white folks on the rail lines as a Pullman porter, a job that would mean he'd be away from home for months at a time, affording him the space to live his other life. It is unclear if Ada ever suspected differently, but historians believe it is unlikely. By telling her straight out that he was a Pullman porter, a job expressly the domain of black males, he would have shut down any questions about his rather incongruous features. And in this time period, being just after the enslaved had been emancipated, that ruse probably served as easy cover for his lie. Black Americans would see that his mixed-race heritage had left him looking white, but they accepted that his identity was what he said it was. The lie is perhaps understandable. While interracial marriage was legal in New York, such couplings were illegal in most states at the time and frankly hard to maintain in a society such as the one Clarence and Ada inhabited in the late 19th century. P.S. It was not until 1967 that the Supreme Court ruled in Loving v. Virginia that interracial marriages were made legal in every state. Now, no one is sure even how they courted, except to say that New York City is a big place and you could quite literally hide in plain sight. The community in which he was well known would not have overlapped with the community in which Ada lived. He was taken at his word. His backstory made sense. His interest in Ada was genuine. He, of course, had to be very careful as he moved between worlds, making sure to strip himself of all the outward documentation of his one life so as not to give any clue about his other. He had to keep his story straight, and there's a lot of speculation about how he did that. He may have chosen a rather commonplace name, his assumed first name was his father's first name, and the combination James and Todd was the same as a man he knew in the Geological Survey who worked in Iowa. This way, he could borrow some details from that life, and no one was the wiser. I know what you're thinking. This usually went the other way, right? That those with a black heritage might have tried to, as the lingo of that day had it, pass as white. The very notion of passing, that is, to appear to be of a different race than you are for convenience sake, even for survival's sake, tends to raise a few hackles. Was pretending to be from a different race a disloyal and deceptive sellout? Or was it an honest attempt to have a better life for yourself and for your offspring in a nation built on white supremacy? Allison Hobbs, an associate professor of history at Stanford University, has done a lot of work on the topic of racial passing. In her book Chosen Lives, she explains how racial indeterminacy at this time created a unique challenge for those many African Americans who, after they were finally freed from the bonds of slavery, had an opportunity to defy Jim Crow laws. But in doing so, they also had to deny their own heritage. A lot of people deemed such actions as a betrayal of sorts. Those who did pass and thus entered into white society may not have realized the bargain they were making. Which is not to say that some were glad to make that bargain. According to Hobbs, those who passed often faced grief and loneliness and isolation because they had willingly sacrificed their identities for material and social gain. Hobbs calls it chosen exile. It's a good time to ask the question about how prevalent this practice was. Let's go on a little side quest now. A 2001 piece in the Ohio State University Law Journal, written by Randall Kennedy, a prestigious American legal scholar, stated that estimates regarding the incidence of passing have varied greatly. In 1947, a guy named Walter White, not played by Bryan Cranston, a civil rights activist and long-serving leader of the NAACP claimed that annually, quote, approximately 12,000 white-skinned Negroes disappear, end quote, into white society. In 1948, journalist and scholar Roel Otley asserted that there were 5 million, quote, white Negroes in the United States and that 40,000 to 50,000 passed annually. But real numbers are impossible to find. Even those using U.S. Census data over a span of decades can't nail it down. The problem is obvious. The legal principle of racial classification that was prominent in this country for all of the 19th century and codified into law in many states was that if a person had even one ancestor of African ancestry, they'd be considered black. That kind of law or rule or social stupidity meant that when, for example, Thomas Jefferson raped Sally Hemings, their children were technically considered black and were therefore enslaved. Don't DM me about that. The only way in which the President of the United States has actual consensual sex with a staff member, or in this case, a human being that he owned, is if he resigns his presidency and goes somewhere to live as equals with said staff member or human being. Jefferson and Hemings' children were noticeably white-looking and so were given the so-called privilege of working in the home of Jefferson rather than in his fields. And here's something I just learned. Genetically, Sally's children were only 12.5% black. That's because Sally was the daughter of Betty Hemings and the man who legally owned her, John Wales, who was also, by the way, Jefferson's wife Martha's father, which also made Sally Martha Jefferson's half-sister. Let me repeat that. President Thomas Jefferson's wife and enslaved mistress were half-sisters. Not only that, but Betty was sadly also the daughter of an enslaved woman from Africa and a white English sea captain. His surname was Hemings. Therefore, Betty had 50% African blood and 50% English and could have only passed 25% of her African blood to Sally. And while our culture so values the male bloodline that female surnames get all but erased from history, apparently when it comes to actual bloodlines and enslaved people, it didn't matter how far back your white paternal line went. If your mother was an enslaved person, so were you. Even if you were the literal fucking child of the literal fucking president of the literal fucking United States of America. Anyway. Children were all eventually freed by Jefferson per an agreement made early on between him and Sally. Beverly, a son, and Harriet, a daughter, left Monticello in the early 1820s. Madison and Easton achieved emancipation under Jefferson's will in 1826. Sally, by the by, was never officially emancipated, though she was allowed by Jefferson's daughter to leave Monticello and live with Madison and Easton in Charlottesville until her death in 1835. Yikes. Madison and Easton had both married free women of color. Easton eventually traveled to Ohio, then to Wisconsin, where he changed his racial identity to white and his last name to Jefferson. According to the Monticello website, Beverly also chose to live as a white man in either Washington, D.C. or Baltimore, where he and his wife raised a family. A vast majority of historians, including the reluctant ones at Monticello, have now accepted the DNA results ferreted out in 1998, sequencing a paternal link to Jefferson in Easton's family line. It is generally accepted that Jefferson fathered all six of Sally's children, two of whom died in infancy. But there was no proof in the late 19th century to establish racial identity, and any kind of personal redesignation into the white race did not sit well with a lot of white people, to say the least. Sandwise told NPR in 2010 that, quote, once enslaved people became free people, many Southerners became very anxious about how they could keep black people in their place, so to speak. How could you recognize a black person if they were no longer an enslaved person, end quote. Hence the advent of the one drop of black blood laws. But wait, this is not what Clarence King did. He decided to pass as black, which is a whole other thing altogether. He was opting to have what his highfalutin friends would have thought of as a lesser life, not a better one. But here's the thing about Clarence King. He decided to keep both his lives. And so it was that a man named James Todd, ostensibly from Baltimore, Maryland, married Ada Copeland of West Point, Georgia, in September 1888 in a small ceremony in one of her relatives' homes. If there had been one, the groom's side of the aisle would have been empty. I don't know how he explained his lack of family to her. Raised in the Congregationalist Church, in a tradition that was reminiscent of the Puritans, in a church whose need for ministerial education created Harvard and Yale, King would have likely not mentioned the precepts of his faith to Ada. Instead, he, as Todd, likely embraced her Union American Methodist Episcopal Church beliefs, that denomination being a fairly recent one, organized as an independent black church to further solidify his black identity. Maybe it was an oversight, maybe not, but the couple never obtained a civil marriage license, meaning that, in truth, they were common law partners. You see, a marriage license issued by the state would have required that the couple individually would have had to specify their race, and King may not have been willing to leave that paper trail. And again, I don't know how he would have explained this away to Ada. As I said earlier, New York was one of the states where such marriages were not illegal, but such a declaration on Todd's part would have been complicating. Still, King was living out his own deeply held beliefs. Biographer Sandwise wrote that he dreamed of a day when the lines that separated us, the Americans of European, African, and Asian descent, would blur into a truly American race. Quote, "Only then," wrote Sandwise of King's desire, "would Americans become conscious of their own ideals and aspiration and find a true and distinctive form of cultural expression," end quote. He also believed deeply in marriage, which meant that he was now taking on the demands and rewards of a commitment, a family, and a bond that he took very seriously. And this would require him to move daily between worlds as he continued to do business in Manhattan and live with Ada in their new home in Brooklyn, a decided step down in every material way for King, a decided step up for Ada, who now had her own private lodgings where she could create a deeply rich life in the black community there. Sandwise told NPR, quote, "In the city of Manhattan, he was the wittiest after-dinner speaker at the Century Club. He was a leading scientist, but he had a secret life. He would move across the Brooklyn Bridge, perhaps shedding his Century Club suit for his Pullman Porter's coat, and go home to his wife, Ada," end quote. In fact, he acquired a separate residence in Manhattan close to his mother, a place for him to stay when he had ongoing business in the city and when he was supposed to be working as a Pullman porter. It was hard going financially, and King had to ask his buddy John Hay for money to keep up his double life, a life that Hay was not privy to. Hay did not know that King was burdened with his mother's well-being and was dealing with his own severe back pain and depression. The latter had required expensive medical care and some rehabilitative travel to Hot Springs, Arkansas. Outwardly, King juggled his lies deftly, keeping on top of two families' worth of obligations and explaining his presence in people's lives as well as his absences with tales of abundant travel and overabundant work. Every year since their marriage, Ada had given birth to a child. First, a boy they named Leroy, which is from Leroy, French for King, and then to Grace, a girl, in honor of a sister of King's who had died young. Of course, Ada did not know the significance of the names because, as far as she knew, there was no surname King, nor was there a dead sister named Grace. Sometime before the third child arrived, a black newspaper in the city covered a party at the Todd home. Even though the affair was designed so that everyone came in costumes and masks, Sandwise says there is no way that Ada would have invited that kind of scrutiny had she known the truth about her husband. I mean, neither would King, aka James Todd, obviously, but apparently there is no record that he was even in attendance at the party. Shortly thereafter, Leroy died while King was away, adding the burden of grief to the already heavy and complicated psychological load King was carrying. Ada drew strength from her faith and her friends. She knew that she had signed up for a less than conventional life. She just didn't know how unconventional. Life went on. King was still a world-renowned geologist who traveled a lot on business, had multiple investment gambles going, was borrowing money from his friends, all the while writing love letters to his common-law wife and trying to pay for the upkeep of the Brooklyn household, his mother's household, and some of Ada's poor relations in Georgia. And then Ada gave birth again, this time to a little boy. But this child seemed to be the proverbial straw that broke the proverbial back. It appears his friends were beginning to get pretty concerned about King. He'd become kind of sloppy in dress, hair uncut, wandering the streets, forgetful. They said they saw it as a pattern that he occasionally fell into. He'd seem okay most of the time, but then would lapse into this incongruous behavior. And then on October 29th, 1893, visitors at the Animal House in Central Park noticed King acting peculiar and agitated. Two cops saw him fly into some kind of rage, then arrested him for disorderly conduct. He seemed distraught. A friend went to find bond money, and by the time he got back that night, King had told the judge that he was being persecuted for refusing to vote for Isaac Maynard. The judge fined him $10. King insisted he had not caused any trouble at the Lion House, but that he had been pushed into an African-American butler, and the ensuing commotion wasn't his fault. Two doctors were brought in and said he was suffering from, quote, mental disturbance with occasional acute symptoms. Despite friends' help to fix all this, he was committed by a judge to the Bloomingdale Asylum for the Insane. Again, it seems Ada had no idea any of this was going on, and she had a new baby at home. No one knows what Ada would have thought if she'd seen the papers that reported that the rugged mountaineering pioneer, Clarence King, was in the hospital with partial lunacy brought on by melancholia. Both terms are no longer used. Partial lunacy, by the way, means like, yeah, this dude is being crazy, but he's not like crazy crazy. He's only partly crazy. Girl, same. No one knows where Ada thought James Todd was. During this time, King's friends took it upon themselves to check on his mother. When he came home after 2 months, he stayed 2 weeks with Ada and left again for 3 months, bound for Havana. Listen, I'm going to be honest. I don't know how or why Ada put up with her husband being gone so much. It's clearly not like he was rolling in dough. It would be one thing, I suppose, if he were gone for long stretches and brought back with him lots and lots of money. But that wasn't the case. He was gone for long stretches and came back pretty much empty-handed, or at least not with months and months worth of salary to show for it, only to leave again a few weeks later. It was an endless cycle, really, that had no good ending. He was home, then back out west to California, then home, then to Mexico. He wrote this letter to his wife sometime during 1896, quote, "I thank God that even if I am forced to travel and labor far away from you, I have the daily comfort of remembering that far away in the East there is a dear brown woman who loves me and whom I love beyond the power of words to describe," end quote. Todd's made an upscale move to Queens in 1897, the same year Ada gave birth to her fifth child, though now only four were living. She also had the means somehow to employ five servants to help with things. She bloomed under the blush of her acceptance into high black society. Her husband went to Alaska to investigate the gold fields there and had a minor heart ailment that befell him in Colorado, where he was forced to rest and recover. It was during this time that racial tensions in New York had begun to bubble up, and King, on the verge of heading to Arizona to more fully recover from his recent ill health, asked Ada to take the family to Toronto to be safe. She did as she was asked. But he had contracted tuberculosis and, once in Arizona, did not improve. He went to California for better care, but got no better. Returning to Phoenix, he was afraid that Ada's letters would not find him as he was hospitalized under the name of Clarence King. It was a name that meant nothing to her. So at long last, after 13 years of marriage, he wrote and told her his real name, though apparently no explanation as to why he had a fake name, nor anything about his real identity. He told her to write the name in her Bible so she would not forget it. King died on Christmas Eve, 1901, in Phoenix, Arizona. He was 59. His mother was still alive, as were his wife and four children, all of whom depended on his ability to keep them afloat. Immediately after his death, King's friends Hay and Gardner had paid his bills and made sure he was returned to New York, where, on New Year's Day, 1902, his funeral, well attended by dignitaries, though not his wife and children, was held. His body was then taken to Newport to rest eternally in the King family plot. The rest was a tad messy, as if this wasn't messy enough. Throughout their marriage, Todd had told his wife that he had established a trust worth $80,000 and had put it in her name. It was allegedly being held by James Gardner, who wouldn't disclose its location, even though he was supposed to. That would be nearly $3 million in today money. Ada was no fool. If she could get access to that money, her family would be saved. She changed her name to Ada King, hired a parade of lawyers, and fought for 30 years to find it. Finally, in 1933, a former secretary to the now-deceased Gardner told the court that his boss had provided for the care of King's mother while she lived, so she did not find out the whole truth of her son's financial failures or of his domestic situation. It is safe to say that Gardner had, by that time, been well aware of Ada because of her continued correspondence with him about her marriage. It is not so clear if King himself had ever let his friends in on his secret life. But yes, the secretary said, Gardner had been supplying Ada as well with a semi-regular stipend on which to live for years. The secretary said that Gardner and another unnamed and much wealthier benefactor had done so voluntarily and out of their regard for her husband. More litigation followed, and despite the secretary's refusal to name the unnamed benefactor, a subpoena forced the matter. The other man who had provided Ada with the means with which to live had been, at first, Secretary of State John Hay. It is not so clear if King himself had ever let his friends in on his secret life. When Hay's widow died, their daughter's husband Payne Whitney took up the payments. When Whitney died in 1927, John Hay's daughter, Helen Hay Whitney, the extremely wealthy socialite, philanthropist, and racehorse owner, continued to send the payments. This, by the way, was all done out of the kindness of the Hay family's hearts. Apparently, King and Hay had been so close that Hay's family took it upon themselves to continue supporting King's widow for many years. But Ada still wanted to know where the money her husband had put into trust had gone. The legal upshot was that it had likely never existed. None of what King left behind indicated that there was actually a trust. And because Ada could provide no proof, documents, legal papers, anything that corroborated what her husband had told her, she was out of luck. Could it have been stolen from her? Sure. But nobody knew nothing. Not bankers, lawyers, friends. She looked for it everywhere, but no luck. Of the four children that Ada and James Todd shared, their two daughters went on to marry white men, while their two sons, who had to register for the draft during World War I, were assigned to an all-black regiment. Later, the two young men would be classified as mulattoes, which was an official designation. Sandwise explains that, quote, in 1880, at the height of the Jim Crow laws and the obsession with defining what black people were, the federal government allowed you on your census form to be white, black, mulatto, quadroon, or octoroon, end quote. Those last two terms meaning one quarter to one eighth black. Strangely enough, though, Sandwise, who is now a professor of history at Princeton, told NPR that, quote, those laws meant to fix race made racial designations extremely fluid. And they made it possible for a lighter-complexioned, blue-eyed, blonde-haired man like Clarence King to claim African ancestry when he actually had none at all. End quote. If you recall, sometime during 1880, Clarence King wrote that he envisioned America becoming a nation that would, quote, melt down into one race alloy, where there are no more Irish or Germans, Negroes and English, but only Americans, belonging to one defined American race, end quote. He really believed it would be done, that it was the best hope for the country to prosper. But just 10 years after that optimistic assessment, in 1890, the U.S. Census category for race offered citizens two choices. Pick one, white or black. But I'm Asian. Not on this piece of paper, you're not. FYI, since 2000, the census has not allowed respondents to identify as mixed race. You can choose now between white, black, or African American, American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian, Native Hawaiian, or other Pacific Islander, Hispanic or Latino, and Middle Eastern or North African. If you happen to be a mix, I guess you're shit out of luck. I don't know what happens if someone ticks more than one box. How does an Afro-Cuban, for instance, mark down their identity on the form? Or an Asian Germanic? If one has to choose either or, even when one is decidedly more than one, doesn't it kind of prove that it's all a construct anyway? If we lived in a world that was truly equal, we wouldn't need these identifiers. Our ethnicity would inform our individual culture, perhaps our taste in food, or our propensity to sunburn easily, or our tendencies towards certain body types. But those are not things the census is concerned with. And if we lived in a truly equitable society, it wouldn't need to concern itself with the other things. We would all just mark down American. Which is, after all, the future Clarence King slash James Todd dreamt of. A future in which Americans are just Americans. A future where one's family history informs their sense of identity, but doesn't define it. It's strange enough that this white, privileged man chose to live a double life in order to be with the woman he loved. But here's what's stranger. Stranger. Why did he go to all that trouble? If he really did believe in equality, and since he lived in a state in which interracial marriage was legal, why didn't he just marry Ada Copeland as Clarence King? Why did he keep her and their children a secret from everyone, including his mother? If his mother and grandmother were such fierce advocates for equality, why did he have to hide his black wife from them? It makes me wonder if his mother and grandmother were less advocates of equality and more advocates of emancipation and hadn't given the aftermath of that much thought. Would they have been scandalized if Clarence loved a black woman? And if he believed so hard in equality as he said he did and wanted to see a future in which Americans' identity was just American, why didn't he actually live out his beliefs by marrying Ada out in the open for all to see? Why didn't he show up to one of his dinner parties with New York's geological elites or whatever and be like, "Here's my wife, she's amazing"? Why did he need to hide her? Was he ashamed? Did he just get a thrill in living a secret life? And if so, didn't that sort of make his feelings for his wife a bit of a fetish rather than a genuine love? Here we are, more than a century later, and TBH, we're not that much closer to the vision of America that Clarence King wrote of, or the vision of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s, whose sentiments were quite similar to Clarence King's and got him assassinated. We still live in a world where the ethnic makeup of a person and how it presents itself affords that person certain privileges or hardships depending. Maybe if Clarence King had done more than talk but actually lived his values, he could have helped push the needle closer to his purported vision. We can now legally marry interracially, and there are more than two options on the census, but at the end of the day, the box we tick on that form often says more about who we are than our own hearts and minds do. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we bring you an episode recorded live at the Witch City Tarot Convention. In this unconventional episode, we'll be going over the totally true, 100% accurate, absolutely not made up history of tarot, a little history on the historic Hawthorne Hotel, and an interview with Sherry D. Benedetti from Ghost Hunters. You are not going to believe some of the stories she's got. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched and written by Amy Wilson and me, Daisy Egan. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.